She Did It Her Way podcast, episode 115, Overcoming Growing Pains with Claire Liu.
Welcome to the She Did It Her Way podcast, a collective of interviews with top female entrepreneurs from around the globe who have done it their way. These women are disruptors, savvy, courageous, confident, innovative, decisive, unconventional, and humble. Our ladies have proven business models, have taken risks, and have failed only for success to follow. Join us as they share their stories, behaviors, habits, mindset, thought processes, and what it is like to be a woman who means business. And now, here's your host, Amanda Bolin.
Hey, She Did Her Way listeners. Happy Thursday and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. And as always, super excited that you guys are joining us, me, today. Yes, well, us, because Claire and I, so that makes us as well. Claire is the CEO of Know Your Company, and in this episode, we're going to talk about how she has overcome her own growing pains as an entrepreneur and helped create the tools for companies to overcome their unique pains as well. So some of the things that we talk about in this episode is know how a bootstrap company works and its benefits, hear how Claire's dad's work influenced her, the value why you can't let your inspiration expire, and so much more. So make sure you guys tune in with Claire Liu, Overcoming Growing Pains. We have the lovely Miss Claire Liu on the Tech Talk Tuesday, and she is joining us on the She Did It Her Way podcast, but our series of Tech Talk Tuesday. And I'm super excited to bring her on and have her share her journey about being a female entrepreneur within the tech arena and having made some pretty big leaps and choices in her life. And so, Claire, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Amanda. I'm super pumped to be here.
Yeah, well, we're excited to have you. tell us where you're at in your life, and then we'll do a little prelude of like leading up to how you got to where you are today, to just to give our listeners some background.
Definitely. So I am the CEO of Know Your Company, and Know Your Company is a software tool that helps business owners overcome growing pains. So we specifically work with small business owners who have about 25 to 75 employees who've started to hire folks. Maybe they've opened up a new office. And when you're going through this process, you can imagine that you start to feel, as a business owner, less in touch with your employees. You start to wonder, man, you know, I don't know what they're thinking about the vision in the company. I wonder, you know, if anyone's going to speak up about what they think about benefits. You feel like you don't even know people's last names anymore. And it really affects how you're able to run your company. And so what we do is we have a really lightweight, easy tool that helps business owners face a lot of these communication challenges and just feel like they can get to know their company again. So we work with, a couple hundred business owners in about 15 different countries. Companies like Airbnb and Kickstarter. And then something else that's pretty interesting about our company is that we were actually originally a product that was built by Basecamp about 2.5-3 years ago. And so, yeah, I'm excited to be here to share that story and tell a little bit about how that all came to be.
Yeah, I remember you, the first time we met, I remember you telling me about that and how it, like, Know Your Company was a subsidiary of Basecamp and all those companies, which is so cool.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's, you know, it's funny because, like, technically it's not even a subsidiary, I guess. What it is, it's its own separate standalone company. So completely, separate LLC. We have our own team. You know, we didn't get any outside funding from Basecamp or other investors. So we're 100% bootstrapped. Wow. We're a two-person company. Yeah, and the ways we do really benefit from our relationship with Basecamp is that they do co-own the company along with myself. And they're really just there as advisors. They're really kind and generous to let me work out of their office a few days a week. So it's a pretty unique setup, though, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, so you said there's only two of you guys working, and you have like over 200 clients or customers.
Yes. No, it's really interesting. You know, being a bootstrap company, the fact that you are deliberately choosing not to take on outside funding, what that means is that Cash flow is everything. You know, you don't have $1 million that someone gave you with some strings attached where you can just go out and hire, you know, 10 people. Really, the process when you do build a bootstrap company is that everything comes from profits. So, you know, every person we hire, every single project that we invest in is all from the money that we, you know, make directly from customers. And so because of that, I'm really conscious about how we grow as a company in terms of headcount and making sure that we stay super focused, really lean, and that we're doing everything possible ourselves first before we look to hire someone else. So far, you know, we've been able to do it with just myself, and then our other employee is our programmer. He works in Atlanta. And so Matt, who is our programmer, you know, he does all of our product development, does some design, does all of our support, and then I do everything else. So our marketing, all of our sales calls, you know, I do a little bit of support. I work with Matt on design, you know, all the business administration stuff. So we're, you know, we're doing quite a bit of, you know, jobs, I guess, for just two people, but we make it work.
That's so impressive though. Okay. Give us some insight as to what has been your path leading up to starting your career at Know Your Company.
Yeah, definitely. So to be frank, I want to say it actually probably started when I was a kid. I remember very specifically, Amanda, when I was 13, I went and I picked up this book called What Should I Do With My Life? Because it was a big question that I was having when I was 13.
Oh my God, you picked that up when you were 13. You're way ahead of the curve, girlfriend.
You know, I had like a, what do you call it? Like a quarter life crisis, you know, one might say, or not even like an eighth
life crisis. You had like a 10th life crisis.
Exactly. The 13 years old went out and bought this book. It has a red cover. It's by Poe Bronson. I didn't even read the whole thing, but I was having this big kind of existential crisis about what sort of career I should have, what I should do with my life, because at the time, up until that point, growing up, I had moved around a lot. So my family had picked up and moved from Georgia to Washington State to Ohio to Minnesota. And the reason we'd moved around so much is because of my dad's job. And so I was always curious as to, wow, am I always going to be moving because of my job? Am I, you know, going to enjoy the work that I'm doing? Because the thing that I noticed with my dad is we moved around because of his job. My dad, he has a PhD in mechanical engineering, and, you know, he would do, you know, I know, a little bit above my pay grade, but, you know, he would be working in a lab to build, you know, robots to help clear nuclear waste, and then actually wanted to go into teaching, and then wanted to go into the industry, and went to go work, you know, as a CTO for a robotics company. But in each of those situations, you know, he was changing because there was something about the work environment where he felt like it could be better, or that something could be improved. And I just noticed that restlessness so clearly because we were, you know, moving schools, we were moving states. I was saying goodbye to friends. Mm. And so, you know, at the age of 13, I was thinking, okay, well, am I going to do that? You know, what am I going to do with my life? What is this thing we call work? And, you know, whatever it ends up being when I get older, I just really want to make sure that I don't feel that same restlessness that my dad feels. God. I want to make sure, yeah, that
You're
I just
so
do
intuitive
something.
At 13. I feel like I hit that stage maybe a couple of years ago, which makes me like quarter life.
I don't know. It's honestly, I think it's just the product of the fact that we just moved so much. And this really interesting thing would happen is that every single day that my dad would come home from work, I would ask him, how's work going? And he would say the same thing every single time, which is fine, right? Mm-hmm. It's fine. It's fine. Yeah, we're moving, right? So I told myself, you know what? I just don't want to say that work is fine. Because clearly it's not when you're just saying that something is fine. And I use that as a self-test a lot. And, you know, it's funny, you know, just many years later, found myself saying that question. And so to kind of fast forward things, yeah. So I ended up going to college. That's what brought me here to Chicago. Went to Northwestern. I studied learning and organizational change. And the reason I studied that is it's really the study of how people work together in groups and communicate with one another is because I was fascinated by this idea of work and, you know, how do you help people work better together? And coming out of college, you know, as I was thinking about that, the other thing that I really took away from my experience at college is I took an entrepreneurship class and noticed that, wow, okay, there's this thing that I've always loved my entire life, which is solving problems. And that in itself is what entrepreneurship is. It's really the process of, you know, seeing a problem, thinking about it, finding ways to make it better, and then seeing the result. That's entrepreneurship. And I became really obsessed with that problem. So when I graduated from college, I started a company with a couple friends. It's called the Starter League, which you might be familiar with. And so I actually helped start that company. Yeah. It's
why does that sound so familiar?
They're a beginner-focused software school in Chicago. Yeah, and they've been immensely successful. The two original co-founders, Neil and Mike, are very dear friends of mine. And you know, really all the credit goes to them. They actually just sold the company to another company that's backed by Y Combinator just, I think, a few months ago. And so they've taught over 1,400 people all over the world. But it was really at a time when coding was not popular. And if you wanted to learn how to code, you had two options. You could either go get a CS degree at college, or you would have had to have been lucky enough when you were 10 years old to have been handed a personal computer by one of your parents and been exposed to it at a really early age. And me and my friends, we had actually, the funny thing is, we the three of us, so me, Mike, and Neil, we'd actually worked in student government together for 3 years. So we'd all been actually, I was student body president my senior year. Mike was student body president his senior year. Neil was student body president his senior year as well. And we'd spent, you know, 4 years working together to help try to solve problems at Northwestern, whether it was meal plans, whether it was, you know, better Wi-Fi in dorm, cell phone reception, you know, in the student center, that sort of thing, that we thought, okay, well, you know, it'd be cool to actually help solve problems in the real world, except a lot of those problems require technology. So we decided to build a school to help beginners like us learn how to solve our own problems with technology. So that was the whole premise of it. And that was... that was a really probably the most important experience that I went through, I think, in my journey as you know, someone who now is, you know, running a company and has since started two companies. And so I think that was such an important experience for me, because at the time I was really young. So, you know, we started it during my senior year in college. I was maybe 21, 22, and you know, it's that whole cliche of working, you know, 100-hour weeks, you know, not sleeping, not eating, all of that, right? And here's the thing, Amanda, I got so burnt out, right? So I ended up losing a lot of my motivation during that process of really even understanding, you know, why was I doing this? Why was I trying to start this company with my friends? Did I even really believe in the idea so much? Who was I really doing this for? I never had taken the time to really ask myself those deep questions about why I wanted to do this. So it was a huge, huge lesson for me, because what ended up happening is I completely burnt out, and I was only with the company for maybe a year. And ended up leaving just because I wasn't even sure if that's what I wanted to do anymore. What, and again, it's just, sorry, go for it.
No, you're fine. I feel like it's one of those where you're at an office meeting and someone's like, oh, I got a question. And you're like, wait, what? Oh, you go ahead. You go ahead. What's something that, you were saying you got so burnt out while you're there. What's something that you learned there that you're very conscious and aware of that now you apply to what you do now?
Yes, great question. I think my greatest learning experience from that is simply to be incredibly honest with yourself and to always ask yourself the question of why are you doing it and who are you really doing it for? Because I think a lot of times, especially, I think especially it happens to a lot of women as they think about their career and their career path. A lot of times, you know, we've grown up in a society that gives us a lot of signals and clues and paths and symbols for what success is. And it's very easy to listen to those things. We get it from our friends, from our parents, from our teachers, from the media, from, you know, different kind of cultural cues. And the unfortunate thing about all those external factors, while of course they're important and you should listen to them and you should always, you know, be receptive to what other people think, the greatest source of, you know, motivation, the greatest source of you being able to accomplish what you want to do has to come from within yourself. And I learned that the hard way, because what I ended up realizing is I helped start Starter League, not because I truly believed in the problem and the solution. I thought it was cool. I thought it was a great idea, but I didn't really believe it to my heart, to my core, the way Mike and Neil did. And because of that, my motivation wasn't sustained. You know, I ended up doing it more because, oh, I felt this obligation to help my friends, or I didn't want to let people down, or I just kind of felt like, you know, it would be the right thing to do without really digging deep into myself and asking myself, what is it that I really want? What is it that I really care about? So I think the greatest lesson I took away from that is, you know, forcing yourself to be honest with yourself, to really dig for that truth, and to know why you are doing the things that you're choosing to do.
Yeah. And I think that's a 100% agree with you too. And I think it's a blessing and a fantastic thing that we as women have such strong intuition that when we're not doing something that's aligned, like our bodies will let us know and tell us. And it's like, we can't just, I mean, we can block out and forget the emotions, forget the intuition, forget all of that and plow straight ahead. But then sooner or later we come crashing down. Where what the beauty is like, we can listen to ourselves and say, like, this doesn't feel right. This does feel right. And so I totally agree with you. So when you left Starter League, you had a couple other positions in between before you finally went to Know Your Company.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So what I ended up doing, because I was kind of so lost and distraught after that experience, is I took some time off. I took a few months off to really think about what it is I wanted to do. I went back home to Minnesota and, you know, stayed with my parents for a month or so. And what I did realize is that I did want to start my own company. I did truly believe to my bones that, you know, my greatest source of happiness comes from helping other people. And I think the best way that I can personally do that is to start a company, is to help create something from scratch. And I felt a really strong pull to that. And so I kind of tucked that in the back of my head and, you know, at the time thought, okay, you know, I do want to start my own company at some point, but right now I don't have an idea really. I also, at this point, I'd never worked for anyone before. And so was thinking maybe it would be a good thing for me to go work for someone else and to get that experience. So I ended up going to work at another company, and it was a really small company, so a really early stage e-commerce startup, and they had about 6 or so people, and I was there for about a year and a half, I want to say, Amanda. Yeah, about a year and a half, and I hated my job.
What did you absolutely not love about it?
Yeah, well, so I'll first tell you the things I did love about it, which is really interesting, I think, because what I did love about it is I loved my coworkers. I got to work with some really amazing women in the company. I thought the work itself was really interesting. I was given a lot of responsibility. You know, I was doing a bit of operations, a bit of design, a bit of, you know, setting up partnerships, marketing. So I got to get my hands in a lot, and it was challenging. But despite all of those positive things, I was still miserable. And the reason I realized is because I felt like I could not give feedback at work. Mm. So in this 6-person company, which is, you know, very small, for some reason, I know, right?
You should Pretty be weird. Able to. That would be like the best environment.
You might think, right? That's what had really stunned me, is that even in this 6-person company, I felt like that even if I were to make a suggestion or point out something in the company that I think could be going differently, I felt like it wouldn't be received well. I felt like nothing would really change. I felt this very big sense of futility that, you know what, my opinion doesn't really matter.
Which kills any and all motivation to even care moving forward. Yeah, exactly. And then you become, you like disengage yourself because you think about like, well, what's the point? And then you have those doubting thoughts, and then it like never, it like manifests in itself into like something not healthy.
Oh, totally. And that's what happened, is it just kind of boiled and boiled, and it affected my day-to-day work, because, you know, how you feel about your work affects how well you can actually do your work. And I kind of learned that the hard way. And I started to think a lot about this problem too, just with my, you know, major being in learning and organizational change, just kind of with, you know, my whole childhood of thinking a lot about this question. And I started to do some research around it of, you know, why is it that there are certain environments within teams where you feel like you can't speak up? Is this the fault of the CEO? What's the CEO not doing? And the more research I did, I realized, you know what, this isn't because my CEO is is a bad person or even a bad leader. What it is that it's actually just a fundamental human problem that occurs in almost every single team, and it's the byproduct of scale. It's the minute that you have, you know, more than a few people in a room, the communication starts to get more difficult. You know, different things fall through the gaps. You get a back channel of gossip. People misinterpret different things, right? And then that's where you create that environment where people feel uncomfortable speaking up. And, you know, I started, you know, thinking, wow, well, if this is a problem, you know, in a 6-person team, what about in a 60-person team or 600-person team? And realize, you know, as I talk to friends and family and even my own coworkers, that this problem was everywhere. And so I ended up getting so frustrated by it, so kind of fed up with it, I just decided, you know what? I'm going to solve this. I'm going to solve this problem of feedback. I don't really care, you know, how long it takes. I have no idea what the solution is, but this is what I want to commit my life's work to. And so I quit my job. Just outright.
Oh my gosh. So you didn't think about it at all. There was no plan. Did you have like some sort of savings or was it like?
I did. No, I had, I'd saved up about like 10 months worth of savings. Nice. So I kind of gave myself, a little runway and told myself, you know, I'm going to give myself 10 months to focus on solving this problem in one way or another. But other than that, that was kind of it. And and so that was, you know, when you talk about taking leaps of making those, you know, sorts of decisions where you kind of put yourself out there, that was definitely one of them. And I think it's funny too, because sometimes I'll have people ask me, Amanda, like, well, Claire, how did you know? Like, how did you know that that was the problem you feel like you had to solve, right?
Yeah, how did you know?
And my thing is, like, you don't really know. All I knew is in the moment, like, I was just so pissed off about it. And so what I tell a lot of people is if there's something that just really pisses you off, like, ride that momentum and just take advantage of that feeling in the moment and ride it out. Because I think actually one of the things that really inspired me is there's a great book that's written by the founders of Basecamp. I don't know if you've read it or you're familiar
with
it.
It's a Signals book, yeah?
Yeah, it's called Rework, and it was written.
Black cover.
Yeah, it's an amazing book. Really short read. I'll take you, you know, like a plane ride to finish. And the last page in the book has a picture of like a laundry detergent box on it, and under it it says that inspiration has an expiration date. So what I've really taken that to heart, and at this time when I was really, you know, considering about quitting my job or not, I remember reading this book on the train and coming to that last page and feeling very inspired about this problem, about wanting to solve it, and, you know, seeing, wow, okay, well, this inspiration, it has an expiration date. It's fleeting. And if you don't just kind of jump on it right then in the moment, it'll really pass. And so, you know, in terms of thinking about, okay, yeah, how did I know that was the right thing to do or go after, or how did I know that was the right problem I wanted to solve? I didn't. I think I just decided, you know, I just decided and took advantage of the inspiration when I felt it.
I agree with you. And especially, I think when we feel the momentum and we got to ride that wave and that window, I mean, that's why we call it window of opportunity, because if we sit on it too long, what starts to happen is that our mind starts creating these doubts. And then we, like, one day, I mean, I went through this when I quit my job from corporate America. One day I'd be like, today's terrible and I'm quitting my job and I'm going to go home. And I, like, looked on Indeed.com and tried to find another job. And then tomorrow I'd go in and they're like, you just got nominated for, like, executive team leader. And then you're like, okay, but it's, obviously being smart and strategic, and you were in a place where you probably had something in the back of your mind knowing all along, like, you knew you wanted to be an entrepreneur, and you were also aware that, like, in order to do that, you have to set yourself up in a position that allows for you to take that opportunity. And so when that moment came, which I think a lot of people, one of my mentors always says that luck is when preparation meets opportunity. And I don't believe that people, if I look at someone and I'm like, they're so lucky, I inherently know that they've done some sort of preparation and the opportunity came at the right time. Before, like, when I was younger, I'd be like, oh my gosh, they're so lucky. They have, like, the nice car. And I mean, this is, like, way back in the day, and I didn't have any form of that. And I just thought people get lucky, and some people might get, like, you win the lottery, fine, whatever. But Sure. As far as people's, like, their success, it's all because people have prepped for it. And so when the moment came for you to just quit, because you're like, this is what I feel like right now, my life's mission, I'm going to take that opportunity. Like, you just, you did it. And
yep.
100% agree.
And it's one of those things too, yeah, where you kind of only see it looking backwards, right? So like at the time, in the moment, you know, you're scared shitless.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Like I had no idea what I was doing. I felt very, you know, a lot of conviction about it, but had no clue as to what this was going to turn out. And so you just kind of have to trust that momentum. And, you know, and I love what you said earlier about, really trusting your intuition. I think that's probably the best, ironically, the best advice I've gotten is, you just have to really trust yourself. Mm-hmm. You can't listen to too many people, if anyone, because no one's you, and no one is going through what you're going through, and everyone's biased by their own, opinions and experiences of, what they have going on.
Oh my gosh. I just listened to, have you heard of The Lively Show?
I have not.
It's a really great podcast. She's been around for a handful of years, and I just listened to her podcast today, and it was like, how do you know and when you know? And she was always saying that people, like you were saying before, people project their own experiences onto other people. So you have to be careful if you are taking advice from other people. Because, I mean, and it's only human nature to do that, but yeah, definitely being conscious and aware of what are you letting in and what are you choosing to listen to.
Yes, I completely agree and abide by that. So I took this big leap of faith, these, 10 months of savings. And what I ended up first doing, Amanda, is I first took a couple months to just try to become an expert on this problem. So I, just read and consumed every article, every book, every study I could get my hands on, because I knew there was a lot of kind of academic research that had been done around the topic. And once I started to do that and get my own opinions of, now maybe this would be a good solution, or this might be a good framework or technique to try to enable people to feel open and honest and giving feedback, I thought, okay, well, that's nice. These opinions and, hypotheses are nice to have, but they're, I need to test them. I really need to test them. So I ended up doing a test case on a company and coming in as a consultant. And what I did is I came in and I did a interview with each employee. It was about an hour. It was 100% confidential. And it had this whole methodology behind trying to get the truth from employees of how they actually felt about where they worked. Mm. And then I pulled all those experiences together. I put together, a really nice report and presented it in front of the company to both the leadership team and all the employees. And the result was pretty nuts. It really helped. People started actually talking about a lot of the issues right there in the room. Some low-hanging fruit things got solved, and kind of some bigger things really got addressed as well. They even had a few people in the company eventually leave, and that was something that was really healthy for them.
Right.
So I noticed this and thought, okay, well, wow, I didn't imagine becoming a consultant. Maybe this is where I'll start, and I'll work with companies one-on-one to help them get to know their companies better. And then at the same time, because I knew I didn't want to become a consultant full-time, I thought, okay, well, I would love to transfer this in some form of software. And I had an idea in my head of what sort of software this could be, but I myself didn't know how to code still, even though I'd started the starter league, still did not know how to code. So what I ended up doing is I actually ended up taking 2 Starter League classes to be able to build my prototype. And so in 11 weeks, I learned Rails and HTML and CSS and built this great prototype. It was neat. I presented it in front of like 200, 300 people because, they do this demo day thing at the end. And funny enough, had companies actually come up to me and say, Claire, where's that for sale? Can I buy that? Like, is that,
oh my gosh,
is that ready? Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, I did not expect that at all. But okay, that's a cool sign. And the product, the prototype, it was very early. I knew it wasn't really ready to be marketable yet, but still very encouraging that I kind of had this seed of something that could be transferred into software, on hand. And I was able to build it myself. So that was really empowering.
And can I plug in really quick here?
Please.
I just want to highlight, so what you're doing, going back to what you said about entrepreneurship, is really just about finding a problem and then figuring out how do I solve it. And in this case, I love how you were so methodical in saying, okay, I'm going to go and work with companies as a consulting capacity and test out the model before going to a massive scale and creating something that you're not even sure if it will fly 100%. And then you created, I'm assuming it was probably your minimum viable product. And then that's when people are like, okay, can we buy it? And I think at that point, when people are willing to pay you money for what you've created as a solution to their problem is like massive. And so whether it's someone in tech or if someone's creating an online business or looking to whatever it is, and you want to create a business, it's asking yourself, like, what is the problem that your target market is struggling with? And then how do you come alongside and provide resources and figure out what is the value to them and what will they invest in your product? So I just wanted to highlight that because you're really strategic on that.
Ah, thank you. Again, all in hindsight. At the time, you're just kind of trying to play the detective.
That's why we do these interviews, so that we can learn.
Yep. No, and you're so spot on, Amanda, because I think the other part of that, is what I was really trying to find and develop was a methodology. Because what a lot of people, especially when it comes to communicating better at work and feedback, what people are really looking to purchase is a system. They want a methodology. You know, they want to know, how do other companies who are successful do this in their workplaces? So that's what I was testing, you know, when I was doing those interviews. And that's a lot of that has actually influenced the product Know Your Company as it is today. So I should actually talk about that.
Yeah.
How that actually came to be. I know it's kind of a long story, but I feel like maybe
high value
the details I don't know. I hope it's interesting at least to someone. What ended up happening, you know, kind of, you know, during this time where I'm taking these classes and I'm doing this consulting project for this, you know, this company as a test case, is I got introduced to Jason Fried, who is the CEO of Basecamp. And, and for folks who don't know a ton about Basecamp, they are a software company. They make project management software. And in fact, I think it's the number one project management software in the world. So they have over 15 million customers. And they're based in Chicago here. And they've gotten every single one of those customers without spending a single dollar on marketing. So it's been completely word of mouth. Isn't that insane?
That is so insane. And for like how big of a company they are. Like,
They're 40 people, which a lot of people don't know as well. They're 40 people and they have millions and millions of customers. Yeah.
A company in terms of like its valuation and how many clients it has. And then it's like employee to client ratio. Like, that's insane.
Yeah, it's nuts. So they are an incredible success story, in the tech industry, in the small business industry. You know, they've purposely chosen to stay, you know, at a low employee count, and goes to show that you can have a big impact without, you know, getting to be thousands of people big. I've looked up to them as a company for a while, and I got introduced to them by actually the CEO of the Starter League. So my friend Neil, who I'd mentioned earlier in the story, and got introduced to Jason and didn't actually even know why we were meeting. So I just ended up telling him, hey, you know, here's what I'm working on. Here's kind of what I'm doing. And when I got done telling him, he said two things. He was like, okay, Claire, first of all, this problem that you're talking about, not knowing your company, is the exact problem that I am facing right now. And, you know, at Basecamp, you know, with 40 some people, it's the biggest, you know, we've ever been. And I just feel like I'm losing touch. And so two things, you know, can we first hire you as a consultant? So can we be your first consulting client? And then two, we happen to be building our own internal product around this problem because it's been so painful. And it's called Know Your Company. And I want to show it to you. And get your thoughts on it. So it was pretty crazy. I mean, when you talk about kind of luck being when opportunity meets preparation, that precise meeting with Jason, I would say, in a lot of ways encapsulated that. It was very bizarre just how timely that was. Just because, they ended up becoming my first consulting client, and the work that I did for them was really, really valuable for them as a company. But not only that, you know, Jason and I kept in touch much about the product. And then when they decided that Know Your Company was just doing so well as a product and they wanted to spin it out as its own separate company, he asked if I would want to run it as the CEO and co-own it with them, but have it be its own completely separate company.
That
and build
so
it from
badass.
And that was about 2.5 years ago. And so I was like, yeah, that sounds pretty perfect. That's awesome. I'll do it.
Okay. So now you've been there. Coming up on 3 years, you've been there almost.
Yes.
I mean, how have you grown as a leader at like being a CEO?
Yes.
Like what's the one or two things that you've like had to overcome or just that really you grew exponentially?
Yes, I think that's such a good question. I think it's two things. One is this idea of managing my own psychology, which sounds like really weird, but there's this great article that Ben Horowitz, he's a VC out in Silicon Valley and has also is a serial entrepreneur, but he's, you know, written a book he's written a book. And anyways, one of the articles that he talks about is this kind of perennial problem that CEOs have where the hardest part of being a CEO is managing your own psychology. So not trying to get too stressed, not being anxious, not feeling like too many decisions you have to make. And the process of managing your own psychology is really whether or not you will be able to be successful or not. And I've definitely faced that firsthand because I think, I don't know, I guess I can only speak for myself, but I know that I am my own worst critic.
Oh, yeah.
And I also know that I can be very hard on myself. And so being able to brush things off, being able to tell myself that it's okay that everything is not in my control because that is impossible. Learning to be patient with myself, learning to take vacations, learning to work more reasonable hours. That has been a learning process. I'll tell you, you know, the first year that I worked, you know, being, you know, served as CEO for Know Your Company, I worked way too much. And I guarantee you, Amanda, I would have gotten the same results with not having worked as many hours.
What's the fear that drives, or maybe, I mean, I'm assuming it's fear because I think we overdo as humans, like a lot of things out of fear. What for you was driving you to overwork yourself in that point?
Yeah, I think it's imposter syndrome. So feeling as though, you know, I'm in this position, put in this position, not sure if I feel actually fully qualified, not sure if I'm the best person for the position, feeling like there are so many other people who could be doing this better than me, not feeling like I really truly deserve it or belong. Which is all complete BS, right? Because the only person who's thinking that is me, to be honest.
That's right.
No one else really cares or is paying attention, you know, that much attention, to be honest, to sort of dig in and try to make those sorts of judgments. But it's really interesting, you know, the way the human mind works. And I think especially for a lot of entrepreneurs, there are very, very, very few entrepreneurs I've met who have not felt imposter syndrome. But it was definitely motivated by a lot of that, of feeling as though, you know, I don't really know if I deserve to be here or I'm good enough to be here. So that definitely, was a big theme, I think, in my first year. And then, I did a really drastic shift in my second and now coming up on my third year of running the company, where I told myself, you know, if Know Your Company is going to be the thing that I, fingers crossed, do for the rest of my life and hopefully am able to run for as long as I can, well, I better be doing it sustainably. I better be doing it in a way where my stress is manageable, where I'm not freaking out about things, where I'm actually taking time off, taking vacations, and doing it in a way where in the long haul, I'm going to be able to keep doing it. So I changed a lot of kind of work habits and life habits because of that. So that's probably the biggest thing I've learned. I think just one thing to add real quick, the second thing I've probably learned too is just how important focus is. So
tell us more.
As a two-person company, as you can imagine, we really can only work on really one thing at a time. Maybe two sometimes, but we really try to only actually purposely work on one thing at a time. Because what that ends up doing is it actually causes us to be really, really devoted to that one thing. Mm-hmm. And so we pour a lot into it. And so the quality ends up being higher. It means, yeah, we do move a little bit slower probably than most teams, but it's actually really beautiful. It means that we're always working on the most important thing. It always means that we have a high impact in terms of what we're doing and a lot of clarity about why we're doing something. So I've really tried to use that focus as a competitive advantage. And that's a big thing I've learned too, because I don't think I thought that starting out.
Yeah, I mean, I call it shiny ball syndrome, which I totally am victim of that. Used to be, I'm getting better, but if anyone's listening to this podcast and they know me, they're probably like, yeah, whatever, you'll have ideas for days. And it's true. And I get excited because I'm an emotional person, but I've gotten better to say, like, let me have my moment of excitement and then check back with me in 2 days and I'll be like, you know what? Nope, that's not the best idea of my use of time. And then I'll be like, nope, check it off. But like, I get really excited initially. I'm like, oh my God, I love ideas. But all that question for you is, have you also learned to like structure your days or your weeks? Do you have any sort of like Mondays you do this, Tuesdays I do that. I have 4 hours of focus time. Yes. So what does that look like?
Totally. Well, it's I try to do it. It can be hard week to week to stick to it, but I'm pretty religious about not scheduling any meetings on Mondays. That's something that I try really, really hard to do because, yeah, I do a lot of writing and you just can't get writing done in small spurts. And so Mondays, no meetings. The first half of the week in general, I try to reduce the number of meetings unless it's something like this, unless it's like a podcast that only comes out on Tuesdays, right? Yeah. Then I'll talk to you on Tuesday. I found if I can try to just clear out when my most productive times of days are, which is typically, and actually I think there's some studies that have been done on this, is that you're most productive early on in the week and earlier in the day just because you're fresher.
Yeah,
because you're fresher. Like, you're tired by Thursday and Friday. You're just so ready for the weekend naturally. And by like, 4 p.m., not even 6 p.m., by like 3 or 4 p.m., you're like, I got to do something different. I got to get away from my desk, right?
Yeah.
So I really try to block off mornings, no meetings. I really try to save like Thursday and Fridays for my meetings, for my sales calls, those sorts of things. Again, exceptions always, but that seems to really try to help, just preserve that precious early in the week and early in the day times as much as I can.
Yeah, I'm totally a believer in that. I think it was a Tim Ferriss podcast that I was listening to, and he was talking about energy units and obviously, how many decisions we make a day. If we have only 100 units of energy and we make extra decisions that we don't need to make, like figuring out what we're going to wear, what we're going to have for breakfast, or what are the things that I'm going to do, like those eat up your energy. So if we can have some sort of system ahead of time to determine that, then we don't use those. But that's why we should never go grocery shopping when you're hungry, because you're in a state of like helplessness. That's why I like can't go into Whole Foods when I'm hungry, which I rarely shop there. Yeah. It's more like Aldi's now, which I love Aldi's. But anytime I go into Whole Foods, I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to buy everything, like the almond meal, and I want to make my own cacao bars. And I'm like, I can't help myself.
Oh yeah, it's done. That's bad news. You can't do that. Yeah.
So anyway, that was such a tangent. I'm sorry about that. I get really excited about food. Last couple of questions. One question, do you have any apps that you use that you love for whatever reason or purpose that you couldn't live without?
Ooh, yes, definitely.
Please share.
Naturally, Basecamp. Mm. I'm not just saying that because, they help, partly co-own your company, but in actuality, we could not run our business without Basecamp. We do everything through Basecamp. And actually, I feel like one of the big reasons why we do that is because, or why I feel so strongly about that is because I got to work with some of the Basecamp programmers and designers when we were transitioning Know Your Company. Mm-hmm. And I learned and saw how they use it. And I was like, oh, okay, I got to get on that plan. I gotta like whatever they're doing, like we gotta be doing, and it just completely blew my mind. So again, like I always feel like people are always looking for like a methodology and like a system, and so I felt like I learned their method of using Basecamp, and so can't live without Basecamp. I also really love 1Password for all my passwords. Like that actually saves.
Is that like LastPass?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't. Okay. Yeah, I don't really know about anything about LastPass. 1Password, they're actually a customer of ours, which is really cool. But what it does is it just stores all your passwords under 1Password, which might not seem that safe, but it is. believe it or not. And it's just like a really nice UI. You know, as someone who's running a business and you have a million logins for your PayPal account, your bank account, you know, your Stripe account, your, you know, how many different things you have. It's just really, really handy. And then I'm trying to think what else. I don't know. Those are the, kind of the top two that come to mind. Oh, one last one, actually, since I do a lot of writing. The thing that I use to write is a tool called Draft. And I don't know if you're familiar with Draft.
Wow,
it's awesome.
I know that right now.
It's draftin.com. And it was built actually by the CEO of HiRise. So the other spinoff company of Basecamp is called HiRise. Mm-hmm. And the CEO who took over for it is this amazing serial entrepreneur. He started 2YC Combinator companies and then also built this tool called Draft, and it's amazing. His name's Nate Cotney, good friend of mine, and it's just a tool that like gets out of your way and just kind of lets you write.
Which, what is different between that and like using what is it called,
like IA Writer or
no? And maybe I'm not fully understanding Evernote. Like what? What's the difference?
Okay.
Just to kind of give a baseline.
Sure. So the user interface is completely different. So Draft is all, it's built for writers. So if you are writing blog posts, if you're writing a book, if you're writing copy for your website, one thing that happens a lot, at least for me, is when you try to write that in Evernote or in a Word doc or in a Pages doc, there's just too many things going on, too many things to kind of pull you, your attention, to distract you.
This is very true.
And visually, it just doesn't look very clean. And so with Draft, it's just clean. It just feels good. And then it saves your drafts. And so you can compare them as they happen. So every time you make a change, it saves it. And then you can compare them against each other. And so then you can restore previous drafts. And then it's just so easy to use. It's just so beautiful. You should check it out. It's awesome.
All right. I'm going to sign up for that. We'll put those in the show notes, you guys. For
awesome.
Sure. Okay. So the last question I have for you is, if you're life had a movie title and you can make it up or it can be an existing one, what would it be?
Oh man, I would say it would be Trust Yourself. Mm-hmm. Which is a really cheesy movie title. I would never go see a movie called Trust Yourself, but I'm just trying to think of the one theme. I mean, I don't know, it's just not that cool or interesting or sexy or anything.
Yes it is, because it came from you.
Oh well, thank you, Amanda. Yeah. But I'm just trying to think, like, okay, kind of what has been the biggest tenet I've tried to stay true to, and it's just trusting yourself.
Yeah.
I think so.
I think that's great advice as well. So we'll end it on that. Well, Claire, cool. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and your energy. This has been lovely, and same to you about scheduling things in the afternoon. I mean, a lot of the quiet time is done in the morning, but it's nice to be able to have really energetic conversations in the afternoon. So thank you.
Totally. Love it. Thanks so much for having me too, Amanda. This is a blast.
Absolutely. And I hope to see you around Chicago.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in to the She Did It Her Way podcast. Did you like this episode? Head on over to iTunes.com to leave us a rating and a review. We would love to hear from you. And don't forget to check out SheDidItHerWayPodcast.com, where you can subscribe to our email list so you can receive the inside scoop on our latest episode released each Monday. Now, do us a favor and go make it a great week.